that we anticipate will be there, whatever it may be, to try and do something to probe the dark energy and dark matter sector. So here I have a picture. Here I have a picture of the favorite picture of the LHC. We also have a picture of the ILC, what a nice artistic rendition. And then if you try to Google quintessence to look up pictures, you find all kinds of very strange stuff. So I like this one. I think there's a lot of British bands named quintessence, or they like that for some reason. So I like this one that says quintessence getting it straight, because that's what we like to figure out. Okay, so as I said, my focus here is really to talk a little bit, although Ben already introduced some of the ideas. So I'm going to be nice and short, which probably everybody would be happy about, is to try to talk a little bit about how to make connections between dark energy and dark matter, and how we can try to probe them at colliders. And in particular, the scenario I'm going to talk about is connection-dominated quintessence. Okay. And the upshot is really we want to try to figure out some way these colliders to probe this enormous sort of sector of stuff we don't know. And it's going to be in the context of what we call in particle physics the Wimp miracle. The Wimp hypothesis that the dark matter is composed of a thermal wimp. And the prototype TV sort of physics that we're imagining is going to be present and seen, for example, at the LHC is low energy supersymmetry, but it really doesn't have to be that particular particle physics scenario. There are many other kinds of scenarios of TV physics which also have Wimp dark matter candidates, and it's really relevant for any one of them. Right? But since I work on SUSY, that's what I'm going to focus on. Okay. So here's what we want to do in particle physics. We all got excited about cosmology, you know, for the last n number of years or so, and we all have what Rocky Cole calls adult onset cosmology. So we all think that we can try to make connections then with particle physics. We want to understand dark energy and dark matter. So let's just start with the scary one, which is dark energy, and say, what, if anything, can we lowly particle physicists possibly do to try to get a handle on this? And so let's think about what it could be. Well, of course, we don't have any idea of what it could be. But we know, suppose it's a cosmological constant. And somehow there's some explanation of the cosmological constant problem, which is one of the reasons we're all here at the start of this workshop. Now, we know that what can a particle collider tell us about the cosmological constant? Well, probably not that much. But we do know that the cosmological constant problem is in principle sensitive to all the degrees of freedom, all the states that we have in the theory. So maybe we know more about what those things are. Maybe we have a little bit of perhaps we have some insight into what may be actually solving this problem. I know that's a huge stretch. Okay, it hasn't helped us really that much so far. Another issue is we think maybe there's some low energy supersymmetries, some signs of such a theory that one can discover. And we know that SUSY is some kind of stabilizer. I mean, of course, that SUSY is badly broken, but maybe if we have some idea about how SUSY is broken, since SUSY is a stabilizing kind of influence, that maybe this might help tell us something about the cosmological constant. So, of course, this is all very much a stretch, and we can just forget about it from now on, because I'm going to go on to talk about the idea that instead it's some dynamical field. So, in quintessence, as we all well know, instead of thinking about dark energy as a cosmological constant, what we think about instead is it's some scalar field, okay? Has at most gravitational strength couplings to the standard model. Okay. And so here I've written down this equation of state, okay, W sub phi. And we see that it takes that particular form, I'm sure all of you very well know this. Now we know that this is a very light field, okay, and has this very weak coupling, so there's just no way you can ever really get a handle on it in any kind of direct sense, okay, in particle physics. So we can't really probe this. But I'm going to keep that equation of state in mind for later on. Now, the reason why I started with dark energy is because dark matter is something which people have spent a lot of time and energy really thinking about from particle theory side. Okay. There are many, many possible dark matter candidates one can try to motivate within a particle theory context, as opposed to dark energy, where there really isn't almost anything. Okay. So we can have WIMPs, axions, there are many other possibilities. So lots and lots contained in the dot, dot, dot there. Like I said here, we're going to focus on the Wimp hypothesis. So the idea that the dark matter is some thermal relic, okay, I'm going to call it chi tilde, thinking about neutralinos, okay. So it's just some particle. We're assuming it has some non-gravitational interactions, okay. So it's weakly interacting, but not gravitationally strong, a weak interaction. And as Dan showed on his slide, we have this sort of nice formula, which in particle physics we never really write it this way. But the idea is that, of course, with this Wimp miracle, what we find is that
basically calculating the relic abundance of this thermal thermal relic. What you find is that their quantities in this calculation depend on particle physics observables. So in particular, the annihilation cross section of this particle. Okay, and there are parts in this formula that also depend on the cosmology, which in particle physics, usually we just assume the cosmology is completely standard. Okay, we don't think a lot about what's happening, but we just assume that. And then we go through and we actually just calculate. Okay, but here we want to just explicitly state that, of course, it depends on the Hubble parameter at the time of freeze out. Okay. This is the thing that we usually, when we in particle physics think about dark matter and think about WIMPs, we usually have a standard sort of standard cosmologies, radiation domination at freeze out, et cetera. Okay. But the point is, in principle, it's just given by this. And then we have other quantities here, including this XF, which is the temperature of freeze out divided by the mass of the species. And these are actually very, you know, insensitive for all the these other details. And as Dan showed in his talk, for standard cosmology, what we have is we have an expression for the Hubble parameter at the time of the freeze out. And then when you plug it all in, what you find is the mass drops out. And that's sort of how people usually write the formula in particle physics. You never put the mass in at all. Okay. So this is an extremely attractive scenario from the particle physics point of view. And for that reason, it's got an enormous amount of attention. And I think there are basically two main reasons why this is the case. The first one is that there's a really strong particle physics motivation to consider such models. Now, of course, other dark matter candidates can certainly have you know, some particle physics theory which gives you a completely different kind of dark matter candidate. But these type of thermal WIMPs, the thing that's nice about them is that typically we know that if it's sort of a particle and electroweak to TeV scale with sort of, you know, weak interaction strength couplings, it gives you sort of the right amount of relic abundance that we see today with standard cosmology. And we see that in particle physics, usually we do have these extra electroweak to TeV scale particles. So we usually want them because we want to explain things like the gauge hierarchy problem. So we typically have something in our theory. We want to explain electroweak symmetry breaking. We want to explain the Higgs sector. So we have extra particles that are in there doing it. So in SUTY, these are the partners. Extra dimensions, these are sort of conclusive client state, whatever it may be. Okay. You have these extra particles. And very often what happens is when you put in these extra particles, what happens is you can provide channels for the proton to decay unacceptably fast. Okay, so in SUSY, this is the case unless you assume a particular discrete symmetry that protects the proton. So in SUSY, it's R parity that does the job. Okay, so you impose some discrete symmetry on these partners, but to the lightest one is stable. And that's your dark matter candidate. Okay. And this is true, as I gave you the SUSY example, but as I said before, there are many, many other kinds of TeV scenarios. And typically what people have found recently is that they all have some kind of symmetry that you need to impose to, in order to sort of make sure everything's okay. So it can be instead of lightest superpartner or LSP, okay, is what I call it here. You can have lightest Kaluza-Klein particle or lightest T parity odd particle, whatever. So there's always some symmetry that's protecting you. So you have this sort of very nice set of things where coupling the particles that we have presumed can be produced and measures at the LHC are going to be the things that are participating in dark matter. And that's why in particle physics, we're so attracted to this WIMP hypothesis. Okay. As opposed to, say, axions, where you can imagine a very nice, interesting dark matter candidate, but it's harder to see how it fits into a typical particle physics model addressing these kinds of issues. Now, it's also, in some sense, a very predictive and simple scenario. As I said, assuming a standard cosmology of the usual thermal WIMP, you have the decoupling, et cetera, you can calculate everything. We can search for such a particle, a sort of stable-looking particle. At colliders, there's also lots of direct and indirect searches for dark matter where they're looking for such a particle. And the idea, the hope, is that we can actually over-constrain the scenario by data, okay, and get a handle as to what this stuff might actually be. So this is why it is so attractive. Now, of course, the first thing you can say, well, is that in particle physics, we're just assuming that the cosmology is standard. So what happens if we relax that? Okay. So as I've shown you before, this dark matter abundance in this thermal WIMP scenario depends on two basic kinds of quantities, couplings and masses, the things you can measure particle physics at a collider in principle. And there's also what's happening at the time of freeze out. Okay. So when the WIMP drops out of thermal equilibrium. And here, what we want to do is to say, suppose that what's actually happening at freeze out isn't what we think. suppose whatever field is actually responsible for dark energy. So I'm thinking quintessence, okay, and I'm making a huge leap. I'm saying whatever that unknown field is, what if it plays an important role to climate freeze out? What would happen? Okay, does anything happen to this WIMP hypothesis? And actually what you find is there can actually be huge effects, which is sort of interesting. Okay. And the issue really is not so much about the fact that we know this is the field that's, you know, responsible for dark energy today, but just the fact having something else, something non-standard that dominates at the freeze out. And this is basically what we're trying to do. Okay. So here we're going to think about non-standard cosmological expansion. So basically our Hubble frame, this is what's changing. And as was really first pointed out by Salati, this is back in 2002, it turns out the effects can actually be dramatic. You can get huge enhancements, and I'll show you that in a moment. So first, before I do that, let me just say, well, from a particle physics point of view, many people say, well, why are we so, you know, eager to sort of go back and change everything standard that we think is happening? Okay. And I think there are sort of several categories of reasons, which I sort of scattered in somewhat random order on this slide, so I'm so sorry about that. So there are sort of philosophical reasons why one should reassess. There are sort of very practical reasons, and there's also sort of, you know, very optimistic slash delusional reasons. Okay. So in terms of practical reasons, let me start with those. Here would be one example of a practical reason. Suppose you have some particle physics model of interest, and it doesn't really give you something that fits well in this thermal WIMP scenario. So how might cosmology help you fix that? Is it possible? Another thing is what Dan talked about, and I'll spend a little bit more time on this myself, which is what happens if we're so lucky? Suppose we have the LHC, we measure all these, we see a particle that looks like it could be a dark matter particle, okay? And we get some sense of what its annihilation cross-section might be. And let me talk a little bit about that more in a moment, okay? And suppose we also see some signals in dark matter detection experiments, okay? They also tell you something about an annihilation cross-section, right? But suppose they conflict with each other. So let me talk about that a little bit more precisely. So at a collider, what might you measure, okay? So at colliders, what do they actually do? I mean, people have written a lot of papers on this, trying to figure out how to think about measuring dark matter at a collider. But they're not really recreating the process of dark matter annihilation. What they're doing is you're seeing some particle decaying into some other stuff, okay? And you're basically trying to look to see if you have some sort of stable-looking particles and try to figure out something about its channels. So the idea is then to figure out some bounds. You're going to see some range, okay? So either from sort of observing something or not, right? So you'd have some minimum annihilation cross-section and some maximum one. You're going to get some range, okay? Even at an ILC, you'd get some range, okay? Because you're never going to know if you see all the particular channels that you have, okay? And suppose you also have an annihilation cross-section that you've done from some dark matter detection experiment, okay? And so this test of what we call the WIMP hypothesis would be deemed a success if that result that we get, okay, from the cosmological data falls within that band that we see from the collider, okay? And this is sort of all people ever think about. The idea is, what if it doesn't fit in that band for some particular reason? So suppose, instead of being in the middle here, suppose it's over here, out there. What's happening? What is the meaning of it? Okay. So that's the practical reasons. I think philosophically, one can argue that, in general, one should reevaluate standard cosmological assumptions in light of the fact that we know dark energy is present. Okay. And then here are the last two sort of, you know, wishful thinking slash delusions, meaning we want to see if we can actually probe physics at very high scales and understand something about what's happening with dark energy. And how in the heck else are we going to try to connect particle physics to it? If anybody has any better idea, that would be great. We'd be very excited in particle physics. Anybody does? Yes?
As I mentioned in my talk, we have cosmology without dark matter.
Yes.
So how would you check that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, pretty much from the start of this talk, the idea is to try to bring dark energy into the particle physics game through the way it affects dark matter. So you get rid of dark matter, and then we have to start thinking again. And so basically, this is the only way so far in terms of actually LHC physics that I know of personally that people are starting to do this. But it's actually a good question, and people should think about it. So here's another, Ben had this, basically this exact slide. And so the idea is, once again, remember I told you, suppose we have all this wonderful amount of data, right?
In fact, instead of stressing about it, we'd be very excited, right? But, you know, we have collider measurements and we have some examples. So from those annihilation cross sections that I told you before, those limits that you would get from a collider, you can translate that into an upper lower bound, okay, on the relic abundance that you would infer from collider data, assuming standard cosmology, okay? So that means you've measured some cross sections or you've gotten some bounds on them and you're translating them, this is just from the particle physics side, using standard cosmology into this range. And now we have this one that we obtained from the dark matter detection and we say, what happens if there's a mismatch, okay? So suppose if the one from the colliders is larger, then we have to have some sort of dilution mechanism. There's too much, okay? Actually, from the particle physics point of view, this is, in, for example, in the simplest scenarios of low-energy supersymmetry, this would be the most interesting scenario in a way. Because the simplest models, typically now, with the current bounds on superpartners, give you too much dark matter for the easiest scenario. Okay, that's just a fact, okay? There's been, I think, relatively little work on these kinds of dilution mechanisms. Okay, so I'm going to go instead to the other case, which is suppose you have some scenario where the thing that you see at the collider looks like it wouldn't give you enough relic abundance. So you need some way to boost it. And the way you can boost it, one very simple way, suppose that's not the only dark matter candidate. That's a perfectly plausible situation. Okay, in fact, that would be the first explanation anybody would have. At least in particle physics, that would be the first explanation you would have. We're a little hesitant about messing around too much with cosmology. We don't understand it that well. So therefore, this would be the first thing. And I'll talk a little bit at the end as to how one might be able to try to tell between this and other options. But the option we want to think about here is just what Dan was talking about earlier. Extra contributions to the Hubble parameter at the time of freeze-up. And what would that do? And it turns out this will enhance the signal and it can have a big enhancement. So let's assume that, yeah, sure.
Any question? So anything you get from a collider won't necessarily be the intrinsic cross-section, but will be a statement that depends upon, you know, the background influencing what you can actually see.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it'll be very much a cut-dependent statement, experimentally limited lower and upper bound.
This is what you get.
Yeah.
And even here, there's error bars on those. Absolutely.
So the cosmology won't have that.
That's
right.
Exactly
right.
Fly
inside of there.
That's right. I mean, it could. That's the whole point. So the thing is, if you look at these two kinds of bounds that you can get, in particular, the sort of maximum one, this would be something you would get from some limit if you don't really see anything at a collider.
And that could be something because maybe there's some background swamping you or something like that, right? This one would be from actually seeing something, the minimum bound on it. You said actually you can put a minimum bound on the annihilation cross section. Then that's something that you can actually tell. That's what we're actually seeing sometimes with that particle and hoping and basically trying to figure out its main channels. I mean, the idea is that you can't possibly know if you've seen all the channels, but you hope that you've seen the most strong one. Okay. So the thing is, when you worry about whether you fit in here, you have to worry exactly about all those questions you have. So it's not a simple question at all. Okay. And that's why in the end of the day, what we really like to do is go to the ILC where you can really do diagnostics of the thing. But I'm going to tell you later. Yeah, but in the ILC,
you can do a lot more precision things.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and but the point is there, you can really get a little more of a handle on it. Even there, you're going to have some errors.
But if this thing doesn't couple to electrics, ILCs, okay, I'll do
that. It depends on what it couples to, that's true. So we could be maximally unlucky. That's
so we're already being maximally optimistic even by thinking about such things, right? So, yeah. So it doesn't quite fit into the whole.
Fair
enough.
All right. So let's think about the idea that the extra contribution to the Hubble parameter is from a quintessence field, okay? So some scalar field, and we want it to dominate the energy density at freeze out, okay? So usually radiation dominates. Now we want it to be quintessence. And you might say, well, wait a minute, BBN says we can't have extra junk rumbling around. That's absolutely true. So the point is it can dominate at the freeze-out temperature, right? But it has to be diluted away by the time of BBN. And that's going to tell us that this quintessence field has to actually be kinetic energy dominated. Okay? So very different than what we'd usually think about for quintessence, but it's potential energy dominated, which it has to be at late times. But at early times, we don't know what it is. Okay? And so here's the main point. Let's calculate this ratio. So this is this parameter that we're going to use sort of throughout. It's the ratio of the energy density of the quintessence field to that of the photons at the BBN time. Okay? Yes?
When do you suspect that it's going to dominate the energy density, begin to dominate the energy? Since kinetic times scale like 1 over 8 to the 6th, wouldn't you expect it to dilute away really fast?
Yeah, that's the whole point. We want to construct a scenario. I mean, this is the assumption, is that it's dominating here. So what causes that initial commission is another question that we'll try to return to later.
Okay.
You need to embed it. And so what people have done so far in particle physics studies is you can just put that in by hand. But what we really want to do is embed an inflationary scenario, and that's sort of what we'll talk about a little bit later. Yes?
In order to get inflation, you need a vacuum density, which is 10 to the power 60 times the observed,
yes.
Which is absolutely enormous.
Yes.
And that's to get rid of this.
That's absolutely true. Yes, it's absolutely true. So we're not really solving any of those questions. We're just sort of saying, what can happen if this is true? I mean, so it's a huge question. Absolutely. And quintessence in general, just model building in general, is extremely fine-tuned in terms of business. It's very hard to make it make sense, especially from an effective field theory point of view. We will know, right? So this is not, that's not solved by any of this. And they are things, important things to think about, but I have to get attendance, so.
Okay, all right. So,
crazy, right? Because if you think of the energy in this thing being comparable to the other energies in the problem,
I mean, the whole point is you think, well, this the idea is if that's components around, suppose it's similar. And you know, we're sort of taking some extreme case, which typically because you want to have extreme signatures. But if it dominates, as I'll show you, it's quite an enhancement. And so, in fact, I should get to that soon. So here's the dilution, and as we see, this is the one, if it's kinetic domination, so kinetic energy term dominates. So what we'll get is that it can dominate, then it can dilute away. Okay, and this is what Salati pointed out. And he also computed what happens. So we can work it out more explicitly. Here's what we call kinetic domination, the kinetic energy term, the quintessence field, much larger than the potential energy, and also any radiation or matter at that particular time. And so we know, for example, here, this is typically how that ratio is going to scale. Okay. And what we see is we can actually get a large enhancement compared to the time that's a freeze out, okay, to this eta parameter that I defined, which is at the BBN. So you can get a factor of 10 to the 6th in that ratio. And that means, when you factor 10 to the 6th in that ratio, if you go back here, remember the Hubble, a freeze out, is proportional to this, we can get a 10 to the 3 enhancement in the relic abundance. So it can be huge. Okay, so it's a big deal. Okay, in principle. So the point is we always increase it, so you get up to a 10 to the 3 enhancement. And roughly speaking, the way to think about it is that because you have extra matter contributing, or extra something contributing to the freeze out, the expansion of the freeze out time, so you have a higher temperature where the thing actually freezes out. Right? And so you get a larger abundance for the same thermoelectric cross section. The temperatures actually aren't that different. I mean, it's a very small difference, actually. But you're riding kind of on the exponential sensitivity because you're on that, you know, it's not relative to this, you're on that Boltzmann scale. So that's where the big factor comes from. And as I said, Salati pointed this out in 2002. And here, I'm just showing, this is a paper that I wrote with Dan Chung, Casey Kong, and Konstantin Tantchev, where we looked at this, which I'll return a lot more to our results in that paper in a moment. But I just want to point out we have some particular plot here. Here's the relic abundance, the particular thermal wind, which is our chi here. And here's the wind mass. And here we're just sort of pointing out, this is not some realistic example. The idea is just to point out that as we vary this eta phi, okay, so this is something that can range between values of 0 and 1, okay, but we see we get this boost in general. So if you think about over here, okay, so this little yellow band is actually the observational band. So, but here we're not trying to make some theory that exactly fits you in there. But suppose you have some case where your wind mass is up here. You see you gain from eta phi as 0 to 1. You're gaining 4 orders of magnitude. So this is the kind of thing that you can see. Okay.
But can it, the energy in the...
Omega pi is the ratio
that
is the presence at the time of the beam. And that's going to be our parameter that we're going to basically use for that. Okay. So what does this scenario really imply? So as I've alluded to now several times, what it's going to tell you is that if this is actually happening, then what we're going to infer from some collider measurement of LSP properties for the relic abundance and from cosmological data, we'll see a mismatch. And as we see, what this does is it boosts it from the standard result. So that means, suppose your thing shows you some low relic abundance region in your particle physics model. Okay. So in the MSSM, this is actually not most of the parameter space at all. Right? Actually, I should be a little bit more careful with what I say there. The MSSM is an extremely complicated theory with many, many parameters in general of TEV energies. What people usually do is they study what's called minimal supergravity, which is a model where you take the over 100 parameters that you could have in general if you worked on anything possible, and you reduce it to 4. And what they've done is they've kind of actually constructed, studied this is basically 90% of the phenomenology of SUSY is that particular kind of model. And what you've seen is that the WMAP constraints and the relic abundance really do give you a very tiny sliver of that parameter space. Most of that parameter space gives you way too much dark matter. Okay? And for that reason, a lot of people say, oh, well, SUSY's problems with dark matter, et cetera. Too much junk. And I just want to comment, first of all, that that's not at all the case because this is extremely, very particular model. And recently I heard a talk from some of the people that work on these things,
Fair and Tata, and they have now decided to go from 4 parameters plus a sign to 5. And what they find is all of those standard conclusions can fail. Okay, so just to keep in mind. But I will say in general that since the fact we haven't seen superpartners typically doesn't favor the low relic abundance regions. Typically what you need to do to get the relic abundance to be low, you have to increase the efficiency of annihilation. And the way you do that would be near a resonance, or also you can have co-annihilation, so particles with similar masses that can co-annihilate each other. That's what you look for in these kinds of SUSY scenarios. And in particular, what you can do is you can actually resurrect certain particular kinds of LSP candidates in SUSY. In SUSY, the lightest dark matter, the LSP is a neutralino. And the idea is that it has to be some delicate, in these particular supergravity theories that I was telling you about with the 4 parameters, there has to be some very delicate balance, you know, of which types of superpartner composition it has to be in order for it to be just right. In fact, people even gave us a name. They call it the well-tempered neutralino. Exactly little different pieces of it to make it work out. And in particular, what you find is that the weino, so that's the superpartner of the W, of course, and the Higgsino, these tends to annihilate too much because of the weak, because they have weak interactions, right? Whereas the Bino, so the hypercharged Gaetano, is the one that typically doesn't annihilate too quickly. And so we need some, usually some, you know, very complicated mixture. And so the idea is that with the boost, you can resurrect some of these. And some interesting SUSY models from other points of view actually naturally lead you to those kinds of candidates. All right, so we have this mismatch. And the next thing we have is that, in general, this kind of scenario is optimistic for actual the cosmological searches for dark, direct and indirect dark matter, because essentially you have larger cross sections for a fixed relic abundance. And what do these people measure? They're measuring essentially the cross section. So that's a nice thing for them, if something like this is correct. So I wanted to point out that a lot of people actually studied these kinds of things since Solati's paper in 2002. Well, it's not a huge amount, but there have been a number of nice papers.
Say resonance, right?
Yes.
They annihilate through the resonance, but it doesn't mean that you will be, you know, producing this resonance in abundance, right? I mean,
no, that's true.
Usually, what you hope is to produce lots of strong interacting particles, like
neutrinos
and quarks, and they, when they cascade down to neutralina, you may never see this resonance,
no,
like
true.
With a capital A.
That's true. It's all about trying to extract Lagrangian parameters out of what you see in the collider, right? And the point is whether you're on the resonance or not. You're not letting you see that resonance in the collider. The point is, you know, many times these resonances are about, you know, one of them I'll talk about later is what we call the A funnel. So one of the extra Higgs bosons of the MSSM happens to be sort of in the right range so that you can sort of reduce, you know, the dark matter candidate, right? But in that case, the idea would be how do you know you're in the A funnel is to try to figure out what all those Lagrangian parameters on a good Hamiltonian Higgs sector is. That's no easy feat. Absolutely, it's true. So it's not like you see some magical thing with a collider and you know that's the resonance that you have. This is all about trying to extract the parameters, which is no easy business, particularly at the LHC. Okay. But nevertheless, people are spending time thinking about this type of thing. Because once again, the payoff is, the idea is, if we can actually test this hypothesis, to whatever extent we can, try to do it. All right, so at the LHC, what people have done is to basically take some of those kinds of study points and see what happens when you change it to allow this kination effect. And so this is a paper of Profumo and Rubio. They have a very nice long study where they not only looked at these minimal supergravity points, and they changed them a little bit. Now, it's a little hard to see. This is the change in the relic abundance. This parameter they call us some C sub phi. This is very similar to our eta, except for it's actually defined as a freeze-out, so they it's a much larger number. Okay. So that's why you see, well, it's hard to see this anyway, but this is actually orders of magnitude. Okay. So it's like, to translate, our number is probably like 10 to the 6 times. No, 10 to the 6 times our number to do something like this. Okay. And the idea is they just sort of go ahead and calculate. For these typical kinds of regions in these Suzy theories, where you either get the colonizations or the resonances. And they study other non-universal models where you typically get Guinos or Higgsinos as the dark matter,
as the LSP. Okay. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we did. So what we did was we wanted to try to look to see the precision to which the LHC and ILC can probe this scenario. And really what we were doing was following this very nice, really detailed study of Balt, Spataglia, Peskin, and Wazanski from 2006. So what do? They took the standard WIMP scenario within these Suzy theories. And they really looked in detail. They thought about an ILC. So it's 2006, maybe they were a little bit more eager to think about the ILC than we are now. But they thought about an ILC at center of mass 500 GeV, and they thought about an ILC at center of mass GeV. And they said, what can we actually do there? The errors on all the various possible cross-sections for particular models. So they start with particular Suzy models. These are these points here. These are all in this minimal supergravity context. They picked these four study points. This is their sets of parameters. Okay. For those of you who are not familiar, this M0 is the typical universal scalar mass. So all the fermions have superpartners. There's a universal scalar mass for them. The M1/2 is the universal mass for the gauge Enos, the gauge superpartners. Tangent beta is the ratio of the Higgs-Vec expectation values. This A0 is something that's depending, it's related to a universal trilinear scalar coupling. Okay, usually, in many cases, you take this thing, they take this thing to be zero, but every once in a while, you throw it in there. And then the mu sign is the fifth parameter that's the sign, and mu is basically a Higgsino mass term. So it's what's giving you, what you end up doing is you are trading that, you know, essentially giving you a Chargino mass, and what that thing, you trade that for the Z mass and the tangent beta in these theories. Okay. So the point is, these are very standard Suzy kinds of models. People study them for collider signatures all the time. Okay, and these are chosen on purpose by these people to give you what the right amount of relic abundance using standard cosmology. So what they did was they took those points and they ran through a whole bunch of studies at a sort of at these various possible hypothetical ILCs and LHC as well. And what they did was they tried to see, to what precision can you actually get a handle on what the relic abundance you could get from these particular study points. Okay. So they really did a full error propagation of everything you can actually measure. And they're trying to really deal with this question about how well can we determine all these parameters. Right. So what we wanted to do was do the same thing, but for this, assuming that we have this kination scenario at play. And so what we have to do is we have to change the points, right? Because these points, all these numbers here, are chosen to give you exactly the right amount. That's how they choose these numbers. Okay? And so we don't want exactly the wrong amount. We want less. Right? So what we want to do is we're going to actually take, to be for simplicity, what we did was we sort of started with one of these things, and we scanned in some parameter away from their study point in the direction of decreasing relic abundance. And then what you do is that, since these are very constrained models, what you do is you scan away in some parameter, and you watch the thing go down. And at some point, you hit some exclusion region, because this is some constrained theory. And so with only a few parameters like that in the full Suzy theory, there's all kinds of constraints that you run into. Okay. So then we go as low as we can possibly go, and we pick, that's our new point. And then we see, to what extent can the LHC and ILC tell us that there would be, that can they actually tell that there's something that would boost it up? So that's the idea. And I'll tell you a little bit more about each one of these points in general, and why we scan these particular parameters. And what we did also, another reason why we sort of started with their points and scanned was because we wanted to recycle their errors. We did this huge study with the ILC, okay, all these details. And what we were hoping was that we basically just shamelessly recycled their error propagation. And we're hoping that since it's not that different, that maybe it's a reasonable thing to do. But the thing is, the idea was that at least qualitatively, this should be something useful, the starting point for the study. So let me start with one of the points. So this is what I called LCC3. This is what we call a style co-annihilation region. So let me show you, this was the LCC3 point down here. Okay. And it's designed such that this style, which is the partner of the tau lepton, super partner, that is basically quite degenerate with your LSP. Okay. So very tiny splitting in the mass so that they can co-annihilate. Okay. Here's the LCC3 point on this plot. So here's I'm like omega h squared versus this m naught. That's that scalar mass parameter. And so you see this is their point that they chose. They chose it specifically to lie in this green band, which is the allowed band for the relic abundance from the experiments. Okay. And so what we did was we dialed down an m0. Okay. And we get to a point until we hit this yellow region. And this yellow region is something where the LSP changes character and is not the dark matter friendly one. So this is a typical minimal supergravity Susie kind of thing. At some point you change your parameter too much and you hit something where you're ruled out already. So we basically then we go here, we pick our point right around there. Okay. And then what we do with it? We do is we recycle those errors of Preskin and collaborators. And we say we plot omega h squared versus this eta sub phi. Yeah, but that was our, you know, this is our thing between 0 and 1, telling us something about how much kination quintessence field would dominate if it frees up. Okay. And so what we see here is that the LHC would give us this sort of blue band. This little yellow bar, once again, is the experimental data. And so what we see is that essentially, well, it depends on, you know, well, let me put it this way. Essentially, the LHC can't really tell you if the eta phi is non-zero or not, essentially. But the ILC is much, much better, as one would expect, because you can get more of a handle on the properties of the particles at this point. Okay. So this is the kind of thing we were doing. We can do the same thing with what's called a focus point region. So the focus point is something where the scalar masses are actually quite heavy. So if you see here, they're much heavier than the gauginals or any of the other things. Okay. And this is also a case where it turns out you get a big admixing of the Higgs-Zeno as the dark matter, and it tends to have a low relic abundance in general. Okay. And so what we did was, again, we deviated in some point. We calculated the same thing. And here we see that even LHC is giving us some kind of band. Okay. So it's not all entirely bad news if you don't have the ILC. All right. So probably useful to sort of pace through some of these. I wanted to point out that another one is this A funnel that I was talking about to Maxim earlier. This is this particular idea that you have what's really causing the reduction in the relic abundance is because you have this resonance with the, you have this extra Higgs boson that happens in these theories. You know, you have many extra Higgs bosons. One of them is the CP-odd one called the A. Okay, and this thing is something where you can see is actually if you deviate beyond. Here is again the allowed region, and this is how we sort of figured out what our new point should be. We sort of scanned in this M0 parameter. We flipped the sign from their original model. And what we found is we can see this whole funnel region. Okay. And we can pick a point where it goes down as low as possible. Okay. And then from here, we can also study the precision to which the LHC and an upgraded ILC can actually measure this particular difference. This is the dark matter mass minus this A boson mass. And this is the extent to which one can do that. And we can write down a similar kind of study point. This is again with the upgraded ILC. So that's why, and this, the reason why is because this particular point, this kind of funnel region turns out to be a difficult one to probe at sort of a 500 GeV ILC. Yes?
Produced at ILC was the production?
I don't remember off the top of my head, but I will remind myself and tell you. I don't remember off the top of my head. for this particular set of parameters. I just don't remember.
For any set of parameters.
All right, so let me give you the most dramatic case,
which is what we call the bulk region. Okay. This is the case where all the partners are pretty light. Okay, and what you're actually getting to is some case where you have a, we want to hit what we call the Higgs pole. Okay. And so here is the original study point of Peskin and collaborators. And they actually picked one with slightly too large a relic abundance for regions that are a little bit difficult for us to understand. But nonetheless, they did it. And what we did was we scanned on the gauge genome mass. And you see that actually here you get a very dramatic dip. And what I wanted, the reason why I wanted to point this one out was because this is our most dramatic case. And the reason why it was so dramatic was because here, this is the case where now the Chargino should have been seen by LEP. Okay. And so if you naively just scan through here, you might think this region sort of down here, where we picked our L6C1 prime point, might seem to be ruled out because it looks like it's below the LEP Chargino bound. Because it turns out for these new set of parameters, what you have is that you have to reevaluate these bounds because you can get destructive interference between diagrams. So we actually did that. So we found a place where we can get a really dramatic effect. And you see here, we do this, the same kind of plot. In this particular case, since all the superpartners are very light, the ILC is extremely good at measuring their all the properties that you need. And so you have this little tiny region here, whereas the LHC is much broader. So that's the basic idea. So now in the last 5 minutes or so, I'd like to talk a little bit about how we know that the kination is dominating at a freeze out. Okay. And so as I said before, previously people just put this in by hand. And what we wanted to do was to actually try to embed it in some context of an inflationary theory. Okay. And this is the basic scenario, and it's quite simple. Okay. The idea is, let's take the inflaton itself to be the quintessence. Okay. So the idea is we want to find something where we have a field with some energy dominance and coherence to it. And we're imagining we have something rolling along a flat potential in inflation. Okay, and how do we give it a lot of kinetic energy? We're just going to drop it off a cliff. Okay. So instead of having the usual kind of end in inflation where you do this, it just, okay. So we're giving it a kick, okay. So this is the criterion on the potential that one would need for this to happen, okay. And so let me not claim that this is something particularly natural condition, okay. This is just an example of how one might try to figure out how to put this kind of scenario in, okay. So the idea is it's rolling, we drop it off the cliff, and then what will happen is at that point it's kination dominated. And then you can also look at various features of the potential you might need to have, such that it transitions to the usual cosmological constant-like behavior at late times. Okay. And we studied this, and what we found is, in general, there's no sort of very robust generic prediction one can make about the equation of state. Okay. It really just depends, you know, on exactly what the initial field value is, et cetera. So you can construct all kinds of things. None of them are particularly attractive from any kind of particle physics point of view, and none of them are have any sort of improvement. In fact, I would say they're just as bad, if not perhaps worse, because you have to worry about this particular condition for the usual quintessence fine-tuning problem, which is how do you keep that quintessence field so light you need an extremely flat potential, and the usual problem. We also typically need values, field values that go beyond Planck. That's also the generic for quintessence models. So I would say here, let me just put it this way. It's just an example of, let's see what one can do. You would have to do some fine-tuning, absolutely. But you have to do fine-tuning anyway. Okay, so this is what we did.
Tuning issue is not one that comes up in the experimental models.
Okay, well, that's good. Yeah. All right, and so then what one has to do is, of course, one has to reheat.
And what we want is we want to transfer a lot of this energy that it has in the inflationary phase. We want to transfer a lot of it to the quintessence field kinetic energy, right? That's what we want. But we also have to reheat, right? So in some minimal scenario, what we can do is just have gravitational reheating. Okay. Now what we find in that case, you can get a relation between this kinetic energy of the quintessence field and the density of the radiation. Okay. So remember that this ratio of these two quantities essentially was our eta phi. So we're predicting it, okay, in the context of model parameters. So one can flip it, turn it around, and get a sense of what the height of the potential has to be in order to achieve a sufficiently large eta phi to make this effect actually show up. Okay. You see that the more energy you dump into the radiation, the lower the eta phi is going to be, et cetera. Okay. And what you find is actually something quite interesting. This is the result that we obtained. This is sort of, in some sense, rather model independent in that This is just the minimal kind of reheating you can possibly have. So details are going to depend on details on the model, but anything more than gravitational is just going to be more contribution to radiation and lower to 8. Right. And so we find is there's an upper bound on the height of the potential for fixed eta phi. And it turns out that this upper bound is such that the height of the potential is insufficient to make any tensor B modes observable. Okay, so I forgot what the prediction did for that. I think this was more like 10 to 15 GeV, right? So therefore, what you'd find is that suppose you measure those B modes, this is out, quite independently of details of the potential. And that was something that kind of learned. Okay, so the whole point is it's hard to rule these things in, but it's nice if you can try to rule them out as well. So that's one example. Now, this is basically my last slide. So I wanted to say, is this kind of thing distinguishable from the very plausible case that if you have a low relic abundance, why don't we just have other dark matter candidates? And I'd say from a particle physics point of view, and that's what I am, basically absolutely not. There's no way you would know, right? And then cosmology, of course, in principle, yes, and that's what Dan spent time talking about, this idea of extra contributions to H, how might they show up? And so one example of telling you about was within this sort of class of inflationary embeddings, something about these tensor perturbations. There's also issues for leptogenesis because the reheating is quite non-standard in this kind of scenario. This is something that Dan talked about in his talk, and he actually had many other examples, okay, which he explained much better than I could. And so the idea is that, once again, from a particle physics point of view, there's really not much you can say. Okay? But we hope that if you have corroborated cosmological measurements and we're lucky, okay, which we may not be, that we can try to figure out whether to get a handle on this kind of thing. Okay, so the conclusions is just that we want to see what we can do with these machines that we have. We know we have the LHC, although now we know its center of mass energy is going to be a little less than what we originally thought. Nevertheless, we're hoping it can tell us something. And the idea is that maybe it can tell us something about this dark matter connection. And what I also think is important is to think about the fact that if you're thinking about some dynamical dark energy, it's really the kinetic energy term that's distinguishing it from some cosmological constant behavior. So maybe try and think a little bit more about ways in which behavior due to this kind of this kinetic energy term can be seen in some way is something that's useful to think about. And as again, it may be the best probe of dark energy colliders, but I hope I'm not right. Okay, thank you.
So if I understood, you're saying that most of the models, particle theory models that you're looking at, actually tend to overproduce dark matter.
Yeah, what I would
but
say.
But because you wanted to, your hope is to get information on dark energy or cosmological constant from it, you had to cook up a scenario in which it underproduced the dark matter. And then you appeal to the cosmological constant or quintessence to bring it back up to the right amount. Is that sort of the...
Well, the idea that...
That's the idea that...
The idea that if you're too low, that any kind of extra field that's currently dominated, that frees out, can loose it back up.
Right.
Now, in these CZ models that I was telling you about, then what you find is that in those cases, a lot of the simplest models tend to give you too much dark matter. But I'm just saying those are only a particular subset of possible TV models.
Those are the null parameter plus the sine model.
Yeah, the simplest things you can have, most of the time spaces will work. But I wouldn't say they all work.
But it's pretty easy from what you said to overproduce the dark matter.
Yeah,
it's
so easy to overproduce it.
Would, I mean,
you it's can, just as easy to over or underproduce. It's just a cross section.
Okay, but you yeah. Assume that the effect of lambda is really positive, and you're looking for the kinetic energy to allow it. But if we don't know what it is, it could have been negative. Would that have been, had it been negative, would that have been a way to bring some of these simple models more into agreement with observation, the ones which overproduced the dark matter?
Absolutely. It really
good.
Just goes like H.
That's
any further questions?
I have a question for both of these and Dan.
Yeah.
There's something interesting that one could investigate, which is suppose I want to demand that whatever beyond standard model at the eventual big scale give me successful baryogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
Surely that involves some kind of first order phase transition.
Right.
what minimum level of gravitational wave would that also affect? And is that observable by this?
Minimum very
tiny. Absolutely tiny. And not completely unobserved.
Completely unobserved, yeah.
It depends on the mass scale.
It
depends on the mass scale you want to do it at, but to do it at electroweak scale.
It could easily be unobservable. If you're lucky and get away with a high scale.
Sorry, it's generic. Sorry to be negative.
But you're talking about things where you're trying to probe those states at TV scale, like, yes. Right? So you want electroweak paragenesis, then yes. You want a low scale. Otherwise, all those leptogenesis, all those things, they're not really testable.
Not anymore. Yeah. Remember, I gave it. I have a paper this year.
Right. The requirement for baryogenesis and gravitational waves is bubbles.
Gravitational waves require a very violent transition.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So typically, there's a lot of friction or sending through plasma. Especially in electroweak baryogenesis, you use that process of scattering particles from the walls to make the baryon. So you have to have that friction, and that, of course, prevents the gain in energy of the wall. The walls don't accelerate.
So
collision may just run at basic speed, for example, and you get very small.
But you can just look at my plot and the end of my talk. I didn't really have a chance to sit on it, but you can just see sort of the ranges where you have to see stuff.
So now, let's thank for speaking again. Thank you.